It's a pleasure to be here. And my goal is to tell you a little bit about the type of neutrino physics research that some people are involved in, especially more theoretical aspects of that. And this is sort of a long list of what I will try to talk about. I'll just remind you very quickly of stuff you must have heard of before, which is the evidence for neutrino masses. Then I'll quickly summarize what it is that theorists are trying to understand. And the main question, of course, is trying to figure out why neutrino masses turn out to be very small. There are actually two different kinds of things that people are interested in. One is to understand why neutrino masses are very small. The other one is to figure out where does the pattern of the lepton mixing comes from. And I'm not going to talk about that very much. What I'll probably spend most of my time on is a very simple example that everybody knows very well, but I want to use that as a proxy for different kinds of neutrino mass models, at least in spirit. And so I'll spend some time talking about that, and then I'll talk about other ideas that people have and what they're good for. I think one thing that I want to try to emphasize along the way is that we know how to give neutrinos a mass. Actually, we have lots of different ways of doing that, and that the challenge is not to figure out how to give neutrinos a mass, but it's actually to figure out what's the correct way of giving neutrinos a mass, which are two different questions. For people, so I looked this up again. How did it happen? Oh, it's been up for too long. Come on. Okay, sorry. So I looked up. This means I think it's iota electron volts, which is 10 to the 24 electron volts, which is actually very convenient for particle physics people. This is pretty close to the gut scale. It's actually 10 to the 15 GeV. Okay, so very quickly remind you that we've discovered neutrino oscillations. We're very sure it's correct. For those of you who are not into this business and haven't been following very closely, I like to show this slide just as a good example of how well we understand things, is we have studied neutrinos that propagate over very long baselines that are produced in very different ways. So we've studied neutrinos from the sun, neutrinos from nuclear reactors, neutrinos from accelerators, and neutrinos produced in the atmosphere. And they all, if you study the phenomenon at a long enough baseline, they all see a deficit of how many neutrinos you expected to get. You can explain that with neutrino oscillations, and the region of the neutrino oscillation parameter space that you end up with, for example, if you interpret solar data in terms of neutrino oscillation, is this black region over here. And then you look at the Kamerlund experiment, and you get this blue region of the parameter space, and you notice that these two regions overlap. Okay, that means that this phenomenon is probably what's going on and not something else, because it's very unlikely that something else would also allow these two completely different data sets to agree with one another. And the same thing happens with atmospheric neutrinos and the neutrinos from accelerators. Again, you interpret these data in terms of neutrino oscillations, and you get very good agreement with some overlap in the parameter space. All right, so again, we have a very nice phenomenological understanding of what's going on. The idea is that there are two different ways of defining what a neutrino is. You have what are called the weak eigenstates, which are the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. And these end up being linear combinations of neutrinos with a well-defined mass, which are nu1, nu2, and nu3. And what the data have been telling us is what are the values of the elements of this mixing matrix, which is parameterized in terms of three angles and one or perhaps three phases. And then what the data can also tell us is the value of the mass square differences among these different neutrinos. Okay, so that's what we've learned from experiment. And we have this great idea, which is that there are three neutrinos and they mix. And that idea fits all the data incredibly well, which is what I show here. This is sort of the latest fit to all of the neutrino data that we know about. Why is this happening? That's kind of weird. Okay. It usually doesn't do that. But okay, well, I wonder if my, just give me a second.
Is the connector on the side all the way?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. Maybe this, yeah. Sorry about that. So I was here. Let me see if this is kind of...
If it doesn't stop, I can go and get it off
the wall. Yeah, no, don't. Yeah. I wonder if there's something going on with my power. All right. So anyway, so if you take, I'll keep checking this every once in a while. So if you take all the data, then this is what we can measure for all of these neutrino mixing parameters. And one thing you should notice that we can measure many of those at the below the 10% level. And if you want, this is a big achievement for neutrino experiments. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, just a decade ago, we didn't even know if any of this existed or not.
Your screen data that kicks in, right?
Yeah, but it shouldn't, right? So, but you.
Do you mind if I play with the settings?
Not at all.
Okay.
I think you can go here.
For now.
Okay.
And it should. It should be.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
It's all set in there.
You know, I thought somehow what was going on. No, I think we can just do this. I thought what was going on was that it thought that the power wasn't connected, and so it wasn't charging or something like that. Anyway.
Okay, as long as it's like.
Okay, seems to me.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Sorry about that. But anyway, I mean, the main point is that we understand this very well, and we have measured these parameters very precisely. And the only one we don't know whether it's zero or not still is this theta 1-3 value. And if you've been following this at any level, you know that there's a lot of next generation neutrino experiments in process of starting taking data. I actually have started taking data a few months ago that are aimed at determining whether this theta 1-3 is zero or not. All right, so we want to do theory. So what we're trying to do is to understand something. And what we want to try to understand is why neutrino masses are not zero, why they're so small. And the other thing that I said I'm not going to talk about is we also want to try to understand why the lepton mixing matrix and the quark mixing matrices are so different. Now, I don't want to talk about this part of the question because I find that we're not ready to talk about this yet. What I want to talk about more is understanding where neutrino masses come from. And I like to illustrate that by this plot on the left. And that's a plot of all of the fermion masses that we know about. And if you haven't thought about this very much, this is a very puzzling plot. Because first of all, once you include neutrino masses, you notice that the fermion masses span about 16 orders of magnitude or so. And 16 orders of magnitude is a very big number, especially considering the fact that as far as our fundamental theory is concerned, these are all point-like fermions. There's no distinction between these different fields in spirit. The only distinction is that their masses are so ridiculously different. Okay, and we have spent a lot of time trying to figure out where these patterns come from, and it's fair to say that we have failed miserably so far. We have lots of ideas, but they're kind of ad hoc. And we haven't been able to really sink our teeth into it and really come up with an answer that everybody thinks is the right answer, whatever that means. So this is the first embarrassment that we have to live with. The other one I want to point out is if you look at the charge fermions, which are the guys that live up here, first of all, there's a huge hierarchy among those masses as well. Between the electron mass and the top quark mass, you have more than 5 orders of magnitude in the ratio of those two masses. And then the other thing I want to point out, of course, is the fact that in between the electron mass and the top quark mass, there are all these other fermion masses, and they form a nice-looking pattern, if nothing else. So that means that if you start running your accelerator and you start off, you know, below an MeV, you can study the electron, and then as the energy goes up and up, you start to see all these other particles as you go up in energy. So that's pretty much what happened with particle physics in the 60s and the 70s, was that people were building accelerators, and then as a function of time, they were discovering, quote unquote, all these new states. That's not how it worked, but that's kind of how it worked. So this is the charge fermion part of the sector. And what's exciting about the neutrino masses is that they live all the way down here. So neutrino masses are not only not zero, but they're really, really small. And you can even define what really small means. They're really small compared to everybody else's mass. Again, you know, this electron to top mass ratio is about 5 orders of magnitude, but it's actually a lot smaller than the ratio of the electron mass and the largest possible neutrino mass that you can come up with. Okay, so this gap here is actually much bigger than this region over here. So that's one feature that jumps out at you. The other thing that jumps out at you is that unlike this region here, this gap here is completely empty. As far as we can tell, there are no particles that live here. And I should say that this is a pretty generous bound. Probably the right bound for the neutrino masses are is more like over here. Okay, so the fact that they're so small and the fact that there's this big gap here between the neutrino mass and the electron mass that is unoccupied kind of indicates to us that there's something qualitatively different about how neutrino masses come about. And that's where all the research goes to.
But it could still have populated
KV. Absolutely. So you can say maybe this is a hint that there's a lot of other stuff that lives in here that we just haven't run into yet.
So like dark matter.
Dark matter, heavier neutrinos.
That's not ruled out.
That is absolutely not. Well, okay, dark matter, the dark matter that lives here would be warm. So if you're happy with warm dark matter, hopefully that means something. But cold dark matter is over here, is above hundreds of MeV at least. So we would be talking about a realm of warm dark matter. Actually, if you're talking about over here, it's still actually hot dark matter, which is disfavored by observations. Some people are big fans of warm dark matter. They claim it solves some issues with galaxy formation and so on. So yeah, so that part of the space could be populated. It's also kind of fun to say, but there are only fermions here. We can add the bosons. The bosons don't shed much light in the theory because we have a couple of bosons that weigh about this much, the W and the Z boson. And then, of course, all the other bosons weigh zero. So, but that's because of gauge invariance. And then we have the Higgs boson, if it exists, that also weighs at around here somewhere. Certainly less than 1 TeV because we can't have a much heavier Higgs boson than that. So we're interested in the neutrinos. And it's kind of interesting to say that this is actually all we know. We don't know much more than this. Our basis for pursuing this research is really based on this picture. The rest is just a lot of wishful thinking. So. Okay. Yeah.
We have lower bound on the neutrino masses.
We have. We know the mass square differences. So that means that the lightest neutrino could be massless, which is what I try to indicate in this cartoon with this red arrow here. So once you postulate that the lightest one is zero, then you necessarily know the mass of the other two because of the mass square differences. And it can only get heavier if the first assumption is incorrect. So I also like to mention this is the fact that neutrino masses were also kind of a surprise, depending on who you ask. But I think if you ask people who are sincere, they were probably surprised by the fact that neutrino masses ended up being not zero. And the reason, of course, is that the standard model, as we learned in Peskin, doesn't have any neutrino masses in it. And on top of that, if you look at the Lagrangian net phase value, it actually protects neutrino masses from arising quantum mechanically as well. So the neutrino mass equals zero is a firm prediction of the model. So non-zero neutrino masses mean that you have to take the standard model Lagrangian and modify it in some non-trivial way. So you actually need to live with a qualitatively different Lagrangian. And I'll try to give examples of what I mean by that. So I think the bottom line is what makes this neutrino mass research interesting is that you have to take the standard model and you have to do something to the Lagrangian that changes it in some fundamental form. It might be some small way, but it's still a qualitatively different change. The other thing I like to mention, which is important, is to say that we really look for physics beyond the standard model a lot. And the evidence that we have for any physics beyond the standard model is very, very feeble. So anything that we can put our hands on is very valuable. Let's just put it that way. So again, I like to say this in this footnote. There's actually very few things that the standard model does not explain yet. The first one is something that everybody's very familiar with, is that we don't know how electroweak symmetry breaking gets broken. The standard model has an explanation for that, which is the Higgs mechanism, and it makes a prediction, which is the existence of a Higgs boson. So if we find a Higgs boson, then the standard model explanation for electroweak symmetry breaking will be confirmed, but it hasn't been confirmed yet. And I also like to point out that this first bullet here is the reason why the LHC was built, is to study electroweak symmetry breaking. The other thing the standard model doesn't explain is dark matter. So we're sure that the dark matter is something that's outside of the standard model. And again, we're spending a lot of manpower and resources in trying to figure out what this dark matter is, especially trying to observe it in some experiment. And then finally, we don't know why the universe seems to be accelerating today, and that's the infamous dark energy problem. And we know that that has absolutely nothing to do with the standard model particle content. We don't even know if this is a particle physics question or not, but a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about that. So what's the neutrino standard model or the new standard model? The answer is we don't know, and as I said, we can write down lots of different Lagrangians that yield non-zero neutrino masses. So I think the name of the game is not to write down different Lagrangians that do it, but actually to try to figure out which one is the right one. And again, right now, we're in a situation where lots of different possibilities are around, and we probably need more experimental data to figure things out.
Would you say every possibility has been written out
there? Yes. At least in spirit, not at least in gross features. You can try to be creative, but I think it'll fall into some category at least. So you can categorize the different ways of doing that. And I'm sure I'm wrong, but at least that's some. So this is the model that I want to talk about. This is a type of model that I will spend a lot of time talking about. And this is a very nice observation that was done already a long time ago by Weinberg. And it's a very exciting set of logic that you can follow, which is the following. Let's say that you take the standard model and you pretend that it's not the final answer to how nature works. So you say it's an effective field theory. We all believe in that these days, by the way. That was probably not true in the 1970s. But anyway, so if you assume that the standard model is an effective field theory, then you expect to have higher dimensional operators that you can add to the standard model. And you can show very quickly that given the particle content of the standard model, there's one dimension 5 operator you can write down, which is this one. It's a lepton Higgs squared operator. And then all the other operators are higher dimensional than that. So that's actually sometimes people refer to it as the Weinberg operator, because it was first mentioned in this 1979 article. Of course, if it's not renormalizable, these couplings are associated to some energy scale. And if the energy scale is really high, then all of these higher dimensional operators become irrelevant, and we can't observe consequences of them. Except if this is the operator that you have, after electroweak symmetry breaking, what you get out of this operator is a neutrino mass. It's actually a Majorana neutrino mass, because this is an operator that violates lepton number by 2 units. And the number that you get for the neutrino mass is proportional to some coupling that you don't know, the weak scale square divided by this new scale lambda. Okay, and this is to be contrasted with regular fermion masses, which are proportional to some coupling times V, which is the electroweak scale. So if you had followed this logic through in 1980, you would have said, look, if the standard model is an effective theory, the lowest higher dimensional operator that we have is dimension 5. And the observable consequence of this operator is that the neutrinos are supposed to get a mass. The neutrinos are going to be Majorana fermions. And the neutrino mass is probably going to be a lot smaller than everybody else's mass. So if you had said that in 1980, you would be a hero today. But nobody did that, of course. So we can say it in hindsight, and then we can sound very smart. But so the consequences of these operators are all realized. except that we don't know whether neutrinos are Majorana fermions or not. So if neutrinos turn out to be Majorana fermions, it will look very, very likely that this idea is kind of correct. We won't, I mean, the question is how do we test it? That's a different question, but at least the spirit of the idea is there. Now, there's a question which is, if this idea is correct, what's the energy scale where this operator arises? And the answer is we can take the neutrino data, we plug it in, and the answer is that that energy scale is at most proportional to this number lambda divided by y. These y's are relative dimensionless couplings. I can fix the largest one to be 1. So in that language, this number lambda is 10 to the 14 GeV. What this means is that there's some new physics out there which happens at an energy scale around 10 to the 4 GeV or less that's yielding neutrino masses. So that's a good model, but it's not a very exciting model because we don't know what else it does. Okay, we can only figure out what else it does if we dress this up into some renormalizable model. And then we can ask, what are the other consequences of this?
It's below the gut scale.
It's definitely known to be below the gut scale.
Why couldn't you just put in the Majorana mass matrix?
Because that violates SU2. It violates the gauge invariance.
These are neutral.
Right, but they belong to a doublet. And they actually have hypercharge. So the hypercharge and the doubletness of the neutrino prevents it from getting a Majorana mass at the renormalizable level. It's only after electric symmetry gets broken.
What if you wanted to have a direct?
That's what I'll talk about next. You can do that.
Yeah, you can do that.
Absolutely. So that's what I'll talk about
next.
Sorry, go ahead.
What kills off all the other kinds of dimension 5 operators?
It's sheer luck. It's the quantum numbers of the fermions are such that you can't write down another one. Actually, it's easy to convince yourself. If you have a dimension 5, the only way you can construct that is with 2 fermions and 2 scalars,
right,
or maybe 5 scalars, but we can't write that down. So it has to be a 2 fermion, 2 scalar coupling. And the quantum numbers of the fermions are such that this is the only one that you can write down. You can't write down a similar one with quarks. It's the hypercharge and the fact that the Higgs is a doublet. If the Higgs sector were different, then you can write down different operators. So if you had a Higgs triplet, for example, then you could write down a relevant operator for neutrino masses. But if there are new fermions out there, then you can probably have dimension 5 operators, other dimension 5 operators. But we don't know of any more fermions, so we're stuck with those. Dimension 6 are kind of a dime a dozen. There are lots of operators you can write down, because you can write those down with 4 fermions. All right, so here's the Lagrangian that you're asking about. So let's look at a very simple model, which is let's take the standard model and let's add a gate singlet fermion to it. So if I add a gate singlet fermion to it, then you're allowed to write down a neutrino Yukawa coupling, which would look like a neutrino Dirac mass later on. Now, gate singlet fermions are exciting for a different reason, and it's the fact that they're gate singlets. In that case, you can write down a Majorana mass for them. That's not forbidden by gauge invariance. If you follow the spirit of the standard model, which is that everything that's allowed is mandatory, then the most general Lagrangian that you have includes these neutrino Yukawa couplings, but it also includes these right-handed neutrino masses. By the way, these ends are these gate singlet fermions, which we like to call right-handed neutrinos. But you can call them whatever you want. So the most general Lagrangian that's consistent with the introduction of, let's say, 3 gate singlet fermions is this one that I wrote down. It's the old standard model Lagrangian plus a neutrino Yukawa coupling plus Majorana masses for these fermions. Now, this Lagrangian is great because after electric symmetry breaking, it actually describes 6 neutral objects, 6 neutral fermions that are all Majorana fermions and that all have non-zero masses. So this is a great Lagrangian to try to explain the data that we have. Okay? So since we have some data to explain and we have a Lagrangian with some parameters in it, new Yukawa couplings and these Majorana masses, we can ask, let's fit the data with these parameters and let's see what the allowed region of the parameter space is. So that's what we want to determine. We have to determine Yukawa couplings, lambda, and Majorana mass is capital M. Okay, just for the sake of argument, let me pretend that there are three of these capital M's if I have three of these right-handed neutrinos. Let's argue that they're all about the same just because we don't want to get too complicated. So the question is, what do we know about these numbers? The answer is, of course, not very much. But people like to postulate different things. So, for example, if you postulate that these Yukawa couplings are order one, then the neutrino data tell you that these numbers M are of order 10 to the 14 GeV. Okay, that's one thing that you can keep in mind. A different question you can ask is, what if I think I know something about M? So, for example, maybe M is of order the gut scale. In that case, you make the prediction that the neutrino masses should actually be a lot smaller than what we observe, because you would need they would be a lot smaller because if you had the gut scale for M, then the Yukawa couplings would need to be much bigger than 4 pi, which is not good. And then there are all kinds of other indirect arguments that people make for what M should be. Another popular choice is maybe M is the electric symmetry breaking scale, like 1 TeV. Why? Because that's where something happens. So why not make it at that level? So there are all kinds of arguments you can make. They're all very indirect. I think it's fun to ask, what does the data need? So if you look at the data... go ahead, yeah.
Very stupid question, but in principle, do I only need one
light-handed? You need two. If you only have one, then you only give mass to one light neutrino. So one way to think about this is that it's only a linear combination of neutrinos that will couple to the right-handed neutrino. The other two will decouple, and it's only that guy that will get a mass. If you have two, there will still be a linear combination of neutrinos that don't get a mass. And then you have two neutrinos that get a mass. And that's the minimum that you need, because the lightest one could be massless. But we like to say three just because it looks good. I mean, there's really no good reason. There's no anomaly constraint or anything like that. If you believe in SL10 guts, then normally you have one right-handed neutrino per generation, just to complete the 16 of SL10. All right, so let's explore the parameter space. So what do we know about this number M? So you can ask, can this number M be exactly zero? And the answer is yes. That's when the neutrinos end up being Dirac fermions. So what happens is you start out with six neutrinos, and if that number M is zero, the six neutrinos marry together into three Dirac fermions. And it turns out that this M equals zero is actually stable because it's protected by a symmetry. It's that when this number M is equal to zero, then a U1B minus L is a global symmetry of your Lagrangian. And that means that there's no quantum process that will generate a non-zero Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrinos. Okay, so M equals zero is totally fine. And what this also tells us is that theoretically any value for M is fine, at least from a naturalness point of view. At least they're natural in the sense that Toth defined that the symmetry of the Lagrangian is enhanced if this parameter goes to zero.
So this makes the lepton sector look like the quark sector, basically, right?
This choice would make the lepton sector look like the quark sector.
CKM for
right.
MSW.
But what is exciting about that is the fact that if you choose M equals zero, then your Lagrangian really has this B minus L symmetry, which is exact.
Yeah.
In the standard model with massless neutrino masses, you still have this U1B minus L symmetry, but it could be an accidental symmetry, meaning it can be broken by physics beyond the standard model. If you really want the neutrinos to be Dirac, you probably can't allow yourself to do that. If the neutrinos are Dirac and they have non-zero masses, then you really are saying that the physics beyond the standard model preserves B minus L. So that's different from what the standard model says today with massless neutrinos.
I set M to zero, and then I add some higher dimension operator, which breaks B minus L.
Then you would generate non-zero Majorana neutrino masses. That's not a theorem, but it's almost always the case. I mean, nobody can think of a counterexample to that. Because once you've broken a lepton number, then nothing protects the neutrinos from getting a Majorana mass after electric symmetry breaking. So this is this case. The other case is let me call mu this Dirac mass, which is a parameter. I can pick this number M to be much, much larger than the Dirac masses. And what happens here is what's called the seesaw mechanism. is that you have these six neutrinos, 3 plus 3. That spectrum gets split, and you get three neutrinos that are heavy, three neutrinos that are light, and the three neutrinos that are heavy are mostly sterile, that they're mostly made out of right-handed neutrinos, and the three light ones are mostly active. They're mostly the neutrinos that we know. And then you get an effective mass for the light neutrinos, which is given by mu squared divided by m, which is a seesaw formula. And this is a scenario that everybody likes because this fits the data really well. This scenario, by the way, fits the data amazingly well, too. So these two scenarios fit the data really well. The last choice you can make, actually, there are two more choices. One is that m is of order the Dirac masses. This scenario is ruled out, it turns out, because you get a lot of sterile neutrino mixing, and that's ruled out by neutrino data. The last logical possibility is that m is a lot smaller than the Dirac masses, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So these are the possibilities then. So zero is fine, and satisfying this constraint is also fine. Now, when you translate this into numbers, it's actually frustrating, because you only need m to be much bigger than mu. That means that I can pick m to be 1 electron volt. I can pick mu to be 10 to the minus 2 electron volts, and that fits the data really well. Or I can pick, mu to be 100 GeV and m to be 10 to the 14 GeV, and that fits the data really well. That means that I have a parameter space where m equals 0 is fine, and m equals to 1 electron volt and above is also fine. So it's a very, very big parameter space, and only a tiny fraction of it is actually ruled out. I'm sorry, mu is the Dirac mass. It's lambda, which is the Yukawa coupling, times v. So if m were 0, that would be the neutrino mass. Okay? So that's where we are. And let me remind you why neutrino masses end up being very small when m is not 0. Okay? So again, if we're in this regime here, we can integrate out the right-handed neutrinos. We get this dimension 5 operator. And now this effective scale lambda is given by the neutrino mass divided by the Yukawa coupling squared. So we need this number here to be 10 to the 14 GeV. And how do we do that? It turns out that there are three ways of doing that. Okay, either the number m is very close to 10 to the 14 GeV, so the right-handed neutrinos are very heavy, or this number lambda is really small, so the Yukawa couplings are very small. Or you can have a scenario where this is a kind of a hand-wavy notation. What we actually have is a matrix statement that comes into what these couplings are. So you could have cancellations among the couplings, and I'll talk about that in just a second as well. So these are the different scenarios that we have. So either the right-handed neutrinos are really heavy, that explains why neutrino masses are small. Either the right-handed neutrinos are very weakly coupled, that also explains why neutrinos masses are small. Or you have some cancellation that's going on.
So weak coupling is tiny lambda.
It's lambda, that's right. And that's the Yukawa coupling. Yeah, that's what the weak coupling regime is. And again, we normally prefer to think about this scenario, but this scenario is just as plausible, if you want. And if you want to be really fancy, you can say, look, right-handed neutrinos are gate singlets. So they're actually part of a hidden sector. And we know about dark matter, so dark matter is also part of a hidden sector. So we're just making the statement that neutrino masses are small because the hidden sector is very hidden. So it doesn't couple to us with very large couplings, for example. So that's one fancy way of saying the same thing. All right, so let me talk a little bit about the high-energy scenario. That's the one that most people talk about. It turns out that there's an upper bound for m that comes from unitarity and perturbation and imposing that the Lagrangian is perturbative and that the whole scenario is self-consistent. So that upper bound is close to the gut scale. It's about a few times 10 to the 15. That's basically from saying that you want your Yukawa coupling to be less than 4 pi. If the Yukawa coupling gets to be too large, then neutrino scattering would violate unitarity. We don't want that. So that's where this type of bound comes from. The other problem that we have is we can talk about a naturalness problem. So we can ask, do neutrino loops contribute to the Higgs mass by too much? And if you believe in naturalness, which a lot of people do, then you probably would want this number m to be less than about 10 to the 7 GeV, unless you have something like supersymmetry. So if supersymmetry doesn't exist and you still believe in naturalness, we still don't know how the Higgs mass becomes regularized, but we don't want the neutrinos to spiral that, then we have this bounded around 10 to the 7 GeV. Now, this is the scenario then, and the problem with this scenario is not that it doesn't look good, but it's impossible to test. So that's the real problem, is that there's no observable consequence of this that you can hope to test in a laboratory, except perhaps for something called a leptogenesis, which is a way of explaining the matter-antimatter asymmetry via right-handed neutrino decays. And while leptogenesis is a great idea, it's also really hard to test. So I think the only way, well, that's not true, but we will probably only convince ourselves that this idea is correct once we've ruled out all the other ideas that we can test. And if all of those are ruled out, then we might be stuck with this one. So that's all I want to say about very heavy right-handed neutrinos, because they're too heavy. You know, that means that they're impossible to see in a laboratory experiment. So what happens if they're very light? Okay, if they're very light, then of course neutrino masses are small because the Yukawa couplings are very small. And when I mean very small, I mean really small. So if these masses are below 100 GeV, we're normally talking about Yukawa couplings that are less than 10 to the minus 6. And I remind you that the electron Yukawa coupling is about 10 to the minus 5. So we're talking about Yukawa couplings a lot smaller than the electron Yukawa coupling. 10
to the minus 6 is
110. Yeah, so it's not a big deal. And again, you know, from 10 to minus, from the electron to 10 to minus 10, it's the same ratio as the electron to the top quark Yukawa coupling ratio. So not too bad. In this scenario, it's hard to do leptogenesis because the right-handed neutrinos are too light, so we have to live with that. Clearly, if you have a new scale, which is 1 MeV, it's probably completely decoupled from guts or electric symmetry breaking, but again, that's fine. So these are the pluses of this, the minuses of this model, if you want. The pluses are more pragmatic, which is if the right-handed neutrinos are very light, you actually have hope of observing them. And this is what I will talk about a little bit, is that they actually look like sterile neutrinos. And these are neutrinos that you can see either in a neutrino oscillation experiment or another kind of experiment. What's also nice is that the model itself is falsifiable because you have some new parameters, and these new parameters can be bound just from the model itself. So if you don't observe oscillations at a certain level, you can rule out the model at a particular value of right-handed neutrino mass. And of course, I want to remind you that any value for these right-handed neutrino masses is natural, just because it's protected by this global symmetry.
I mean, isn't the sterile active mixing adjustable?
Only to a point. So that's what I want to show. So in this scenario, it's not completely adjustable.
So can you remind us why in thermal leptogenesis, the barren symmetry is proportional to the right-handed neutrino
mass? It's not proportional to the right-handed neutrino mass, but it requires the Yukawa couplings to be relatively large. So that, and because the neutrino masses go like lambda squared over m, if the Yukawa couplings are large, then the neutrino masses have to be large. And then you have more technical issues with deviation from thermal equilibrium and things of that nature that force you into a range of right-handed neutrino masses, which is around 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 GeV. That, by the way, is a problem for supersymmetric theories because of something called the Gravitino problem. And that's actually not so easy to solve. So that's the story there. You can get around that. You can have much lighter steroneutrino or right-handed neutrinos if you do play some tricks like resonant leptogenesis, for example. But I'm not considering that possibility. Okay? So let me quickly show you what the idea is. So this is your 6x6 neutrino mass. And so each entry here is a 3x3 matrix. So there's no left-left mass. There are these Dirac masses, which are left-right. This is lambda v, which I called mu before. And then you have the m's here. So what you can do, of course, is to diagonalize this matrix here perturbatively. And what you get then is a light 3x3 Majorana mass, which is given by the standard seesaw formula, which I said is lambda squared divided by m. But you can keep doing this perturbative diagonalization. So the 6x6 unitary mixing matrix then is given by some 3x3 unitary matrix, the unit matrix down here. And then I have this off-diagonal theta matrix. And this theta matrix then governs the mixing between the active neutrinos and the sterile neutrinos. And this theta matrix you can work out in perturbation theory looks like that. It's basically lambda v divided by m. So it's the Dirac mass divided by the Majorana mass. That's not a surprise. We're diagonalizing this here perturbatively. The first correction to that is this divided by that. And of course, we can relate lambda divided by m to this matrix, at least partially. And when we do that, at the end of the day, I can write down these new mixing angles as the normal mixing matrix that we know about, the square root of the known light neutrino masses divided by the square root of the unknown right-handed neutrino masses. But if I say that the right-handed neutrino mass is, I don't know, 10 electron volts, I can predict what theta is. Not exactly. There's some object here in the middle which is a complex orthogonal matrix that we can't determine, that actually has to be measured.
So you could adjust that.
So I can try to adjust that, but I can only do it to a point because it's still an orthogonal matrix. So what that means is you can adjust that. It's 3x3 orthogonal. So it's governed by six complex parameters. Six real parameters or three complex parameters. It's a complex orthogonal matrix. So you can adjust that so that you can kill off some of the mixing angles, for example. But in the process of doing that, you automatically make other mixing angles large. So the whole system is not completely determined, but it's constrained to some subspace. And that's what gives you hope of actually testing the scenario. And I'll give an example of what this thing can do. So here's a typical spectrum that you can get out. So I can get the normal neutrinos here. And if one of the m's is, say, 1 electron volt, and maybe the other one is, I don't know, 5, and then the other one is 10 to the 3, this would fit all of the data that we have. And what's exciting is that these neutrinos here, if they're light enough, you could study them with oscillations. They would show up as sterile neutrinos. And then people get excited about another neutrino, which is about, 1,000 electron volts, because it could serve as the dark matter. It would be this warm dark matter candidate. So it's kind of a very nice scenario because it's very testable. So we like things that we can test.
What are pulsar kicks?
What's that?
Pulsar kicks.
I'll mention that in just a second. And then just not to mention this, so this is the mini-boom data that I assume you will have seen. And here they have some evidence for some oscillation that's going on. And that would be explained by a sterile neutrino. I don't want to talk about this at all because I don't believe in it very much. And people have done analysis of this, and they get a good fit to the data if there's a new delta m squared, actually two new delta m squareds, which are both of the order of, say, 1 electron volt squared.
So is four the lightest sterile and 5 the next lightest?
That's exactly right. It would be a spectrum that looks exactly like the one that I drew here, where this would be the 1, 4, and this would be 1, 5, 1. And we're in a regime where we can't see the 1, 2, 3 differences. So that's why we only care about this.
It's too tiny.
Yeah. So people have done a fit to all of these neutrino anomalies, and you can almost fit everything with two extra neutrinos.
So that graph there is the colors mean what?
Oh, these are like confidence levels.
Okay.
So you want to be, so forget everything that's below this dotted line, because that's a little bit harder to explain, but it's just as good a fit. So that means that you want one delta m squared to be around 1, the other delta m squared to be about 0.5 electron volt squared. You could probably live here. You could probably live here, and you can
so
probably
red
live there.
Red is bad, blue is bad.
Red is worse. White is bad.
White is really bad.
Right. Okay. And then the colored regions are where you would want to live. And the data, in some sense, prefer the gray regions. That's the way to look at that. Of course, when they do these fits, only look at the bottom here, they also make predictions for what the mixing angles have to be. So you have some new mixing angles as well. So it's this type of physics that you could test with these right-handed neutrinos. So let me talk about another prediction from this, and then I'll and then I'll move on to something else, is that you can study neutrinoless double beta decay. That's something that's very well known. That's the way that we like to study neutrino masses. And the rate for neutrinoless double beta decay is proportional to some linear combination of neutrino masses. So if you have more neutrinos, you have to sum over all of those. So this is what you expect your rate for neutrinoless double beta decay to be. And what's kind of fun or bad about this scenario is that you can show that this sum here is exactly zero. Okay? So that means that, curiously enough, that even though all of the neutrinos are Majorana fermions, the exchange of the light neutrinos is canceled out by the exchange of the heavy neutrinos exactly. That's easy to see because the thing that you're sensitive to, in some sense, is the EE element of the full neutrino mass matrix, which in this case is given by zero, which is what this matrix looks like. So the EE element of that is actually zero. So this model here, for example, predicts that even though the neutrinos are Majorana fermions, the rate for neutrinoless double beta decay is exactly zero, which is a bad prediction because that means you'll never find out whether the neutrinos really are Majorana fermions or not. But if you started measuring more things, you could probably piece this together if
so
you want.
Why is it canceling?
It's when you're doing this double beta decay, if all of the neutrinos are light, this is the object that you're sensitive to. So it's a combination of U squared, which are the entries of the mixing matrix, and M. But it's not U absolute value squared. So this, there can be interferences here. You can check that this combination of elements is equal to the EE element of your mass matrix before you did this diagonalization, right? Because the M's are just the eigenvalues of this matrix, and the U's are just the elements of the matrix that diagonalizes that. So this combination is just the 1-1 element of this matrix, which is zero. So that's why this cancels out. The approximation fails if the right-hand neutrinos get very heavy. So you're not sensitive to this anymore. You're sensitive to something else, and then that becomes non-zero, which I'm going to skip here. I want to skip this as well.
So with exactly cancel, you mean in a perturbative?
They exactly cancel in the limit where all of the neutrinos are much lighter than the typical Q value of your beta decay process, which is about 500 keV or so, MeV or so. Is that right? Or sorry. I can read off the number. It's around here somewhere. I'm sorry, 50 MeV or so. 50 MeV is the inverse size of these nuclei that people talk about. So I do want to mention this. What's bad about having these new light neutrinos? One thing that's kind of bad is that it screws up cosmology. These neutrinos are very strongly coupled in the sense that they become thermal in the early universe. And that's totally ruled out by things like BBN, for example. So if you have this scenario going on, you certainly need some new non-standard cosmology to be happening. On the other hand, people say that maybe these guys make good warm dark matter, as I mentioned in the beginning. People like to say that they help out with our process nucleosynthesis and nuclei. And I don't want to talk about this. I'm sorry. Our process nucleosynthesis and supernovae. And then they have this peculiar velocities that they seem to be able to explain. I can say a word about this. What happens is people observe that neutron stars have larger peculiar velocities than they're supposed to have. And hopefully people know. So peculiar velocity is the velocity of the star in the system where the star lives and not the velocity that we measure, because that one usually has some big redshift and stuff like that. So the model then is that when the neutron stars arise out of the supernova explosion, they're born with a kick. So that means that the supernova explosion gives the leftover stuff some kick or some momentum. And since we don't understand supernova explosions incredibly well, it might just be a consequence of the explosion itself, that maybe the explosion is asymmetric, and that explains why the neutron stars all get a kick. The problem is that it needs a really big kick if you want to explain it with the explosion. And people have postulated that maybe if the neutrinos come out asymmetrically from the supernova, only a small asymmetry in the neutrinos would give the star a kick because the neutrinos carry out most of the energy. So In order to do that, the idea is to have the neutrinos oscillating into a stereo neutrino. And roughly speaking, the idea is you can postulate that there are magnetic fields inside of the supernova, which means that, and magnetic fields will polarize the matter through which the neutrinos are propagating in a way that will modify neutrino oscillations in the direction of the magnetic field and in the direction opposite to the magnetic field. So if you could have lots of stereoneutrinos being produced, say, in the direction of the magnetic field, and very few against the direction of the magnetic field, that would mean that you can emit a lot of stereoneutrinos early on in one direction and not the other, and that would give you a momentum imbalance that would give the whole star a kick. That's the idea. And people claim that that is possible to explain in some region of the parameter space. This is the mixing angle mass parameter space.
For the heaviest stereo.
That would be for a very heavy stereo. Yeah, this is around a keV or so. Okay, so this plot has a lot of information in it. There's another problem. So gray is the region of parameter space where you overclose the universe.
So that's ruled out.
So that's ruled out. And of course, our scenario lives here. So it's totally ruled out, the one that we were talking about in our paper, for example. But the whole point is that usually our mixing angles end up being too large from this seesaw scenario that I'm talking about. So that's the one.
That lower right. Lower left area.
It's hard to populate this lower left area unless you do that area is allowed.
It's allowed.
That's right. But again, remember that I told you that my mixing angles are constrained. And I can't come up with a way of moving all of my mixing angles towards this region. I can move some of them, but I can't move all of them here. So that's what I mean that the models is falsifiable that way. All right, so let me just give an example. What happens once the right-handed neutrinos get heavier as far as the phenomenology is concerned? So, you know, what if you pick M to be, say, a GeV or so? What happens is the mixing angle starts to get smaller and smaller because it's proportional to active neutrino mass divided by M. As capital M gets heavier and heavier, the mixing angle becomes very small. And then at some point, the right-handed neutrinos are so weakly coupled that there's no physics process that we can produce them through. Now, we can go back to this expression and look at this R matrix again. And there's one thing that it's easy to do with the R matrix is to make the elements of the R matrix really big. Making them very small is hard because of the orthogonal relationship. You can make them very big because they're complex. So because it's a complex orthogonal matrix, you can basically make it up of, if you want, hyperbolic sines and cosines. So you can make the magnitudes of these things to be arbitrarily big. So if you do that, you can violate this naive scaling for this mixing angle. Now, you can ask,
sorry.
Yeah?
I don't understand quite, but I mean, you already explained, but how can you have this complete freedom in choosing R? Because, I mean, in the end, if you were diagonalizing a matrix numerically,
you
have a mixing angle.
You can't violate the assumption you made to begin with. So the assumption was that lambda V is a lot less than M. So that's the assumption you did to have the perturbative diagonalization of the matrix be consistent. You can't violate that. So that kind of puts a ceiling on how large these elements can be. And then you also want the theory to be perturbative. So you don't want the R's to be arbitrarily large so that your Yukawa couplings are 100. Okay, that would be bad. But mathematically, that's the only constraint that you have to live with. So let me try to give an example of what's going on. I think it's in the next slide. So how does that happen? So let's pretend that there's only one active neutrino and two stereoneutrinos, okay? In this language that I wrote down, my theta matrix is proportional to this number, which is the light neutrino mass divided by the heavy neutrino mass, times some complex angle, cosine of a complex angle, okay? At the same time, my Yukawa coupling is given by this expression here, the Yukawa coupling times V. That's correct, yeah. But it does have an upper bound. It can't be more than 10. That's the only thing that I'm using.
But that's because your perturbation theory won't be reliable.
That's part of the problem. I think the... You could give that, are you saying that I could give that up?
Yes.
I could try to give that up, but then I don't know what to make with the theory. At least I personally don't know. I think one way of saying this is that if you, you would naively think that the theory breaks down before you get to the mass of the neutrinos that you have in your model. Just because the simplest diagrams that I write down will violate unitarity. That just means that perturbation theory was broken down and you have to add up all of them. And I claim that I don't know how to do that. So I, that's my personal concern about that. You could have a very strongly coupled theory, but then I also claim that it's very hard to understand why it manifests itself at low energies in this way. Basically, that means that I shouldn't expect to get these operators that have coefficients of this size from an unperturbative theory. I think it would be, the manifestation would be more subtle. So that's all that I'm saying. Anyway, so just to finish the story. So this is your Yukawa coupling, and this is your theta. And again, I'm telling you that I can make theta, I can make this zeta here complex and very large. So for example, I pick a point here, and then I just make this zeta, I don't know, 10 times I. And then this becomes hyperbolic cosine of 10 and hyperbolic sine of 10. These mixing angles can be huge, okay? Now, what this means in terms of numbers is the following, is that I'm actually picking, if I pick this number here, which is a random number, then that means that one of my Yukawa couplings is 0.244. The other Yukawa coupling is minus 0.244 times I. The neutrino mass is this particular combination of Yukawa couplings and masses. And you notice that this number cancels out exactly with that number when you take the squares. So what I'm really doing is I'm making the light neutrino mass very light because this number is canceling off with that number. That's effectively what I do when I make this this entries here really large. Okay, so that's the price that you pay. And the numbers are not crazy. I mean, this is 0.2, and this is 100 GeV. What is crazy is the fact that this number square cancels out almost exactly with that number square. So it's very finely tuned. Actually, they have to cancel out at the 10 to minus 13 level, which is really bad, yeah.
So just to understand better, if you would require your Yukawa couplings to be real, then you don't have this R.
You would not be able to do that, or the R matrix would be trivial. That's actually, it would not be complex. It would still be an orthogonal matrix. It would be a real orthogonal matrix. Okay, and I can show you later. That's actually easy to show. All right. Since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to talk about this case because it's kind of weird. But so let me just talk about the last case and then I'll stop. So physically, you can ask the opposite question, which is what happens when the right-handed neutrino masses are a lot less than the Dirac masses. This is kind of the opposite of the seesaw. It's sort of the anti-seesaw, if you want. And what happens here is that you still have 6 Majorana fermions, but they form what are called as pseudo-Dirac states. So the general idea is that you have 6 fermions whose masses are ordered kind of like this. So they're almost, the masses are almost identical, but not really. And each one of these states is a 50-50 mixture of an active neutrino and a sterile neutrino. So the question is that allowed by the data? And that's the other analysis that we did. So one thing that happens is you can calculate, for example, for solar neutrinos, what's the survival probability of your electron neutrinos. And you get curves that look like this. So this, for example, is the electron neutrino survival probability. And then this red line is the probability that the electron neutrino will oscillate into a sterile neutrino. And this is as a function of my new delta m squared in the theory, which I write down as epsilon times the known solar delta m squared. And this is for values of, I don't know, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8. And you see that you get these really big effects. So for example, if you look at the red line, that tells you the probability that an electron neutrino born in the sun will be measured as a sterile neutrino. And you can see that that number can be almost 60%. So you get a feeling that this is probably not allowed by the data. So you can look at the data. This is kind of what we measure. So we can measure this electron neutrino survival probability as a function of energy. And we know that it has a shape that kind of looks like this. Okay? There's a feature to these data, or a problem with the data, is that we don't have any data in the middle here. And not having data in the middle means that if this curve did something that went like this, for example, we wouldn't be able to tell. Okay, so that's what, these are the sorts of things you can get away if you start messing around with neutrino oscillations in the case of solar neutrinos. Then there's another technical problem that people worry about, is that the normal oscillation picture predicts that this curve is supposed to turn up like that, and the data that we have at high energies doesn't really indicate that yet, because the error bars are still large. So if you look at this black point, that's the most precise one. It's not, it doesn't give you an indication that this is actually going up. If anything, it seems to indicate that it wants to go down, but statistically speaking, it's not significant. So this is what we have to live with, and then we can make a fit with our hypothesis that the neutrinos have this, these tiny splittings and that they can mix with a stereoneutrino. So this is the kind of analysis that we get. So if the new mass splitting is really small, then you don't get to see anything because your new oscillation length is too long. Then you have some region where this is not, so this is a chi-squared plot. So you want chi-squared to be small. So this value of epsilon is kind of ruled out. You get some local minimum here. This is when you have a very big effect, but the big effect is in the region of the energy space that we haven't made any measurements. And then it kind of oscillates away. But the exciting thing is, it's probably true that if epsilon is bigger than about, say, 10 to the minus 7, the scenario, this is ruled out. So we can rule out then very, very light right-handed neutrinos, but only up to a certain mass. So since I've talked very slowly, let me just conclude with this plot, and then I'll go to my conclusions. The idea is, here's my seesaw space. So these are the masses of the right-handed neutrinos. And like I said, if the right-handed neutrinos are really light, if you're going into your Dirac regime, everything is fine with the data until you get to about 10 to the minus 9 electron volts. So 10 to the minus 9 electron volts is ruled out by solar neutrino oscillations. So this region between, say, 10 to the minus 9 and about 1 electron volts is ruled out. And then above 1 electron volt, the parameter space is fine. So that means we still have a lot of work to do. And in terms of hope, we hope that for light masses, that these this is the guess that you make for the active stereo mixing angle, that these mixing angles here can be probed in next generation experiments. And maybe they're already being probed by things like Mini-Boon and this reactor anomaly and so on. So if we live over here, that region we might be able to test experimentally. This region from here on probably requires that we do a little bit more work or that we get very lucky.
So what are the distinctions between those three different curves?
Right. So the ansatz for the active stereo mixing angle squared, it's proportional to this number. It's the active neutrino mass divided by this thing that I call the right-handed neutrino mass. So the problem is I don't know what the axis. These are different values for active neutrino masses. So this is as large as the active neutrino masses can be. And I have three of them. So there's a logical possibility that somehow one of the right-handed neutrinos only talks to the lightest one. And that's why I have this number 10 to the minus 5 there. So this gives you sort of a range of ansatz that you can make for what the active stereo mixing is, because it depends on things we haven't measured yet. That's the purpose for that. Okay, so let me skip this last thing I was going to talk about, and then let me conclude. So again, just to conclude on talking about doing research with neutrinos, we need to make more measurements. And what kind of measurements we would like to make comes from lots of different places. So we like to study charged leptons. So we care about things like a charged lepton flavor violating experiments, or maybe a G-2 and EDM type experiments. We also would like to know if the neutrinos are Majorana fermions or not. So we check for whether lepton number is violated or not. Of course, we want to look at the results of neutrino oscillation experiments, because they might reveal, say, stereoneutrinos or new neutrino interactions or stuff like that. And we look at other neutrino scattering experiments. We also care about those, things like Minerva, for example. And finally, there's always this question as to whether neutrino masses have anything to do with LHC physics. And the answer, of course, is that we don't know. It really depends on which model you like. And it's also gotten popular nowadays to write down models where you can test the new physics in the neutrino sector at the LHC. And these are perfectly fine models, but they're usually written with this motivation in mind. It's not like it's a nice model, but it's a model that's written down so you can test it at the LHC. So that's something to keep in mind. But of course, if it happened to be true, then it would be very nice, because then we would be able to study the origin of neutrino masses at a collider experiment. Okay, so again, let me conclude. I showed you very quickly that we are very sure that the neutrinos have mass, and that we understand masses and mixings or their values very well from experiment. We also have learned that neutrino masses are very small, and that's what we're trying to explain. Again, we have different candidates for what kind of a Lagrangian explains where neutrino masses are coming from, and that we need more experimental information to decide which one of those is correct. Probably figuring out whether the neutrinos are Majorana on a fermion or not will help, because it will at least tell us what kind of a Lagrangian we're aiming for. And we don't even know that yet. So again, we know very little about how neutrino masses get generated. It could be, like I said, that the neutrinos are just like all the other fermions. I don't think we can say that that's implausible. It would be weird, but on the other hand, fermion masses are weird anyway. This would be kind of boring, because we wouldn't see anything else that comes out of this, which could happen. Of course, it could be due to very, very heavy physics. And that's the scenario that most people are willing to bet on. But I think the problem with making this bet is that you'll never be able to collect your money, because you can't ever verify that this idea is correct, even if it is correct. If it's wrong, it's easy to show that it's wrong. But if it's right, you won't be able to convince yourself that you're right. Of course, it could be due to very light physics. And in that case, at least you can test the model. You can rule it out. And even if you don't like this, at least this model is a presentable model, because at least it can be falsifiable. So that's why I think that's kind of interesting to think about. Of course, it could be due to physics at the TEV scale. That's normally too weakly coupled, so we shouldn't be able to see it at the LHC, unless it's not, in which case interesting things can happen. And of course, you know, what makes neutrino research exciting is the fact that we're sort of at the mercy of experimental data. That means we need more. But it's not the kind of experimental data that will never come. We think it'll come very soon. Very soon means, you know, within this decade or so. So there will be a lot of new work to do, and we hope that the data will guide us towards some interesting scenarios that we'll have fun with. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you. Yeah.
So, what about gravity?
Ooh, what about gravity?
I mean, it was possible for solar neutrino oscillations to be explained by differential gravitational couplings.
Correct.
Nobody's ever way to count neutrinos. And then when Snell came along, I mean, nobody pays attention to that anymore, but I've never known if that's because it's fully ruled out, or because people just don't think it's quite as much fun, or if there's some...
No, so that's a... Once upon a time, as you say, before Snow came along and ruined everybody's fun, what happened was there were lots of different mechanisms through which you could explain the solar neutrino problem. That was one of them. That's one of the exotic ones. There are other ones which are, if you want, less exotic, that have to do with the neutrino having a very large magnetic moment, for example. So it would. That's right. But what happened, that scenario gets ruled out because of the, not because of Snow, but because of the reactor neutrino experiment, Kamlind. So Kamlind is an experiment with a baseline of 100 kilometers, where you don't expect these non-standard gravitational things to have time to operate, because the operators would have to be huge, and you still see the same effect. So because you see oscillations both from the sun and from this very mundane reactor experiment, where you don't have this huge baseline to accumulate phase along the way, that's why these scenarios are ruled out.
Well, but they're not ruled out, except it, I mean, the idea was they could all be massless in different gravity, but certainly they could have mass and still couple differentially with gravity. That's not ruled out, is it?
That is correct. That's not ruled out,
it's
but...
not as minimal.
No, 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 yeah.
But it's so,
But the mechanisms that people had in mind at the time are completely ruled out by these reactors.
Yeah, they wanted no zero mass.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mass.
So there is still the possibility that these effects are there as subleading effects. And that's, I think, where we stand right now, is that you could still have the neutrinos be probing that, but it's not. But it would have to be as a perturbation on the regular mass oscillating effect. That's what I'm pretty sure of. And I think you have to go back and remind yourself, how is it that the different gravitational couplings to the neutrinos is affecting the neutrino propagation from the sun to here?
Well, they scale as energy, and the mass mechanism is inverse with energy. Right?
That's correct, yeah. So these are the sorts of things that we've measured. So I had forgotten about that. So one thing I was going to say is that since it scales with energy, it's E times L. Actually violates Lorentz invariance too, by the way. But that's fine, because there's gravity. So you can say, that breaks Lorentz invariance. So because it's E times L, you also get a different expectation for the oscillating pattern with energy. And again, the Kamlin experiment measures that. They actually have seen an oscillation. And that also puts a big damper on anything that doesn't go like L over E. What people have been able to do, for example, is to make a fit to say this is an oscillation that looks like L times energy to some power n. And then you make a fit for what n can be. And the fit is that n is around -1 with a relatively small error bar. So it's still true that you could test effects like this with neutrino oscillations. Neutrino oscillations still have these huge baselines, and it still has the quantum interference nature to it. That's why you can see these effects, which are very small. But right now, they can't explain any of the phenomena. They can just be subleading effects that you can still fit because the data are relatively coarse. But if the data became more precise, you would either be able to rule them out or to see these subleading effects.
But what about, could we not believe in sterile neutrinos that couple differently to gravity?
Absolutely. You could definitely believe in that. And again, because the evidence for sterile neutrinos is very feeble, I think all that we can say now is that if there are these sterile neutrinos, we can probably place a bound on how much weirder they are as far as gravity is concerned. Because we don't have any observations yet.
Has anybody ever done that?
No, not that I know.
It seems to me that might as well be looked at, right? It remains logically.
Absolutely. I think the problem with these approaches is that they're theoretically weak, right? They're not based on a formalism. They're more, you add an ad hoc modification to the dispersion relation of a propagating neutrino.
I guess I would challenge that a bit in the sense that if you believed there were sterile neutrinos that mm-hmm. coupled differently to gravity and
right.
produced some thumbprint of the signature that we're seeing, then you'd know that one of the most fundamental
and as a violation of a principle,
it's falsifiable.
As a violation of a principle, I totally agree. I think that we don't know how that violation would manifest itself exactly. So we have to do some phenomenology to fill in.
Yeah, you would. I agree.
And so then you say, am I really testing the nature of gravity, or am I just testing this particular parameterization of how the violation of gravity would happen?
Well, it would be a mixture.
It would be a combination of the two things. So you could always say, you're not really testing modified gravity, because I could modify it in this other way, where it would be invisible to this particular phenomenon.
But given what's going on, you want new ideas. And
I agree completely.
Then,
no.
No, we don't want that.
No. Okay, so I agree. This is it's a good idea. And there are all kinds of interesting phenomena that you can test just because of this oscillation nature.
I mean, the difference
let's
is...
Let's maybe see if there are more questions.
Sorry.
And I guess it's open for discussion.
Yeah. But I just want to
know. No, but it's a...
The difference in energy. Right.
I absolutely, yeah. I think people do play with this, but what they often do is not to. In the end, if you measure something, you would measure a violation of the L over E behavior of the oscillation, and then you would go and ask, so what does that mean? And the answer is we have no idea. It could be that gravity is weird, or it could be that Lorentz invariance is violated, for example. And then how do we tell those two things apart? The answer is not with neutrinos. We would have to tell those things apart with something much, much different, because the neutrino oscillations are only sensitive to one thing, which is whether it goes like L over E or not. So people have played games with, what if the neutrino dispersion relation is weird, is anomalous? And that includes all kinds of different effects. People have talked about violating Lorentz invariance. They've talked about this quantum foam description of, so I think that's more related to what you're talking about. And they all lead to the same effect at the end of the day. So in that sense, we have studied this a lot. But we know we oftentimes don't give it any name. We just say, let's test this in the neutrino oscillation. And then if we see a violation from that, we don't know where it's coming from. But it just means that we have seen something. But we haven't seen it yet. People do study, for example, all kinds of funny effects like directional dependency on the neutrino oscillation, where the neutrino is going that way and neutrinos going that way oscillate differently, like a Michelson-Morley type experiment. We can measure that. We haven't seen any effect yet. But if we do see something, we will have to figure out what it is. And I claim that we won't be able to get much more information out of neutrino oscillations other than the observation of the effect. So maybe that's a better answer. Right.
Is, will that make a strong difference between whether they are Majorana or?
That's a very good question. And the answer is that the masses are too small. So what happens is, let's say that the neutrinos are Dirac, or if you start out with massless neutrinos, if the mass is zero, then you can't really ask that question. And what happens is that if the mass is zero and there is a right-handed neutrino, it doesn't couple to anything, so it never gets produced in the early universe. So the number of neutrinos is 3. If the neutrino is Dirac but has a very tiny mass, the right-handed degrees of freedom are never in thermal equilibrium. So what happens is, as far as the history of the universe is concerned, it always looks like you have a massless two-component fermion and not a four-component fermion. So because that interaction is never in thermal equilibrium, you can't answer whether the neutrino is Majorana or Dirac just by counting how many neutrinos there are. Because the universe is such that it never gets to populate the right-handed neutrino states in thermal equilibrium. That's right. So even though you would in principle think you have two times more states, these three states are never populated.
But you might actually have, I mean, these right neutrinos may have electromagnetic properties like
that would change the picture.
Dipole moment, so that you could
that if
change the temperature.
If the dipole moment were large, so for example, if the electron didn't have charge, it would not populate. The Yukawa interaction would not be in thermal equilibrium ever. For example, the mass is too small. But because the electron has charge, you know, everybody gets populated. But if the neutrino has a magnetic moment, then you might be able to do it with a photon, but the bounds on the magnetic moment are too stringent. So we know that the magnetic moments are less than something, which again leads to this interaction not being in thermal equilibrium. So life could change. You know, if the neutrino talks to the dark matter through some strong interaction that knows about the right-handed neutrino component, maybe. But with the standard model, we can't answer that question with looking at how many neutrinos there are, unfortunately. People were very confused about this, by the way, some 20 years ago. Somebody had to write a very short paper explaining why you couldn't do it that way, because people were confused. I think it's a Langacker London paper or something, which is a nice paper. I think it's half a page or something. But yeah, that's the idea.
I guess it's a good point to stop now. Mm-hmm. Let's thank
you. Thank you.